For the week of December 2nd, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 431, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Katowice, Poland, I'm Michael Giltz.
I have no idea what you're even talking about.
It's just global warming, Sperling. The end is nigh. Every country in the world is gathered in Katowice, Poland, to talk about global warming, to follow up on the Paris Accord. Ironically, Poland is one of the biggest users of coal in the world, and they've doubled down on it. They're like one of the few countries building a new coal plant. But it's a big conference. It's very important. Time is running out. And I mention it because Sir David Attenborough is there.
Okay.
He's famous for his nature documentaries. And there is a slot at this meeting, this incredibly important conference, for the people's representative. And David Attenborough, as a beloved British figure and a famous nature documentary filmmaker, is there reading comments from real people that have been sent in to represent the voice of the people of the world to say, for the love of God, we need to do something and we need to do it now. It's sort of ironic because he's been criticized over the years for not being loud and vocal enough about the dangers of climate change and the threat to animals and plants and birds and everything and human life in the world amidst his document. He does have statements in certain films, but people feel like mostly his planetary documentaries are sort of feel good and don't emphasize what a, you know, vital global threat we face right now. So he's making up for it. He's 92 years old, and there he is stepping up to the plate and making something happen.
Wow. I was wondering, how in the world is Michael going to like spin this into an entertainment news story? And you managed to do it.
I did indeed. The end is nigh. So that's exciting. And to prove it, there's no show next week.
That's true. Because, you know, why plan when, you know, why plan a show when, as you say, the end is nigh?
Sperling is going back to the future.
That's true.
He's traveling through time into the future next week. That's very exciting. What are you doing?
I am going to CineAsia in Hong Kong.
Oh, very nice. Very, very cool. How long will you be there?
I will be there for 6 days.
So you'll have about 2 days of consciousness.
Correct. I was going to say, so I will be awake for all of about 45 minutes.
Well, that's cool. And then 2 weeks after that, we're going to miss you again because it's right around Christmas Eve, and that's not going to happen.
Correct. Yes.
So it's the week of December 2nd. So next week, we won't have one. The week of December 16th, right in the middle of the Christmas season when lots of movies are coming out, there'll be a lot to talk about. We'll have a big show. And then right before New Year's Eve, we'll probably have a big show too, right around the week of December 30th. So mid-December, we'll have a show. This is all your fault.
Pretty much.
And then right on New Year's Eve, we'll have another show. So we're only going to hit episode 433 by the end of 2018, but we wanted to let you know in advance so you could plan accordingly.
That's true. Yes. Thank you.
And you know, every week we quote and link and react to stuff in Variety and Hollywood Reporter. Every single episode of Showbiz Sandbox is filled with their work. And we also criticize them from time to time because they're the Bibles of the industry. And so we care so much about what they say and do, because if we feel like, oh, that's not quite right, or the context isn't there, we know everyone's going to read it in those outlets. So because we criticize them sometimes or try to, you know, give reactions so they can get better, we should give a tip of the hat when we get a chance, shouldn't we?
That's true. I guess they cleaned up and dominated the 11th Annual Arts and Entertainment Journalism Awards. Variety got the most nominations, but The Hollywood Reporter won the most awards, 11 in all. But Variety won like the biggest award of them all, Best Entertainment Publication, which has got to hurt Hollywood Reporter in some way.
Well, you know, congrats to both of them. They both have some really good coverage. And when they talked about some of the stories that were winning, it was stuff we talked about, like that coverage of Grey's Anatomy and Ellen Pompeo's negotiations and how she stepped up to the plate when negotiating her terms on the show. So congrats to them all. That's what they were talking about this weekend at the Arts and Entertainment Journalism Awards. What are we going to talk about this week on Showbiz Sandbox?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're feeling a little sleepy thanks to the post-Thanksgiving-induced naps we've been taking, but that won't stop us from covering the box office and all the news from the world of entertainment. First, award season is clearly upon us, with the National Board of Review and the New York Film Critics weighing in on their favorites, and yes, that includes The Favorite. In Book Filter news, we take an x-ray of the state of indie bookstores. CBS News declared, they're back! We wish we could say the same. Sperling got his wish, by the way, and that's me. I'm Sperling. So I got my wish, apparently, on sexual misconduct news. Wait, what? You can blame me or Neil deGrasse Tyson? I don't even know what that means. On Inside Baseball, we focused in on the Battle Royale taking place in India. Everyone recognizes its growing power, and everyone wants to be competitive when it comes to music and streaming video in that country. Who's winning? Well, just find out who can answer that question in Tamil.
Oh!
In parentheses, it says...
Nan Vin Rain. Nan Vin Rain, I'm winning. to say me is Inya. Inya. Okay. I forgot to... I wasn't ready for my cue. That's right. I looked up the Tamil way to say I'm winning.
Okay.
But I blew it. Oh, well, it's live, people.
Well, of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes, but we're pulling an audible here. I think they actually missed a Tamil film, to be specific. It's 2.0. They had that way down at making $4 million this weekend. But from what I can see, it made $40 million this weekend. So we've pushed it all the way up to number five. So we're always trying to pull information from everywhere we can. In that case, it was Wikipedia, which led us to another source. There's also Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Reporter, you are listeners. So if you know about a movie that should have been on this list this week, and at number 25 is Crazy Rich Asians, which made $1.2 million, almost all of it in China. If you know a movie that grossed more than that worldwide and it's not on the list, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
That's right. So back to the top of the list. The number one movie around the world is Ralph Breaks the Internet. $60 million on the weekend, $207 million worldwide. This is just getting going. Great reviews, great hold in North America. It's got a lot of territories to expand, so it's doing great. And number two is Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald. No, it's of Grindelwald, I think. $51 million worldwide. That's at $520 million and counting. Not good reviews, not great box office in North America, but it's a big, big world. And in that place, Fantastic Beasts is doing just fine.
Yeah, I think in North America, the last Fantastic Beasts movie made $235 million domestically. And I don't think it's going to get there.
No, it's a 135 right now.
Yeah, so it's in its third week. So, yeah.
Right. Yeah. At number three is Bohemian Rhapsody, another $45 million on the weekend. That's what it costs pretty much to make the movie. It's at $540 million worldwide. And number four, another hit animated film, Dr. Seuss's The Grinch, $45 million on the weekend. That's at $270 million worldwide. And number five is our audible, the film that we've pushed up from way down towards the bottom of the list. It's 2.0. This is a Tamil film, a Tamil language film from India. I think it's the most expensive Indian film ever made. $75 million budget is what they're reporting. It's a sci-fi musical sequel to Enthiran, which was a hit film about a robot discovering its humanity. This time, the robot and his partners are going after smartphone users for damaging birds and the environment. So it has an environmental impact theme, which is, I'm sure, appreciated by Sir David Attenborough there in Poland. Music is by A.R. Rahman, of course, and it grossed $40 million on its opening weekend. So it had a terrific launch. We'll have to see how well it holds. It seems to have gotten pretty good reviews. But boy, this is a big film, and India is a hard market to crack. And it's hard for ComScore. If people don't tell them what a movie grossed, then they don't have the data and they can't put it on their charts. We found that out, but it just proves to you how hard it is to keep track of what's going on in that giant continent. And we'll get more to that in Inside Baseball. And number six is Creed 2, the Rocky spinoff. $26 million on the weekend. That's just about to hit $100 million worldwide.
Well, is it a Rocky spinoff? Because if it's Creed 2, technically it's a sequel to the spinoff.
Well, I would say it's sort of a reboot of the Rocky franchise by taking a character and, you know, spinning off from that. But who knows? It's in the Rocky universe, I guess, as they would say today. And at number seven, we may see a Cool Fish universe. This is a big hit film in China. We've talked about it before. It's a Tarantino-esque sort of action comedy. $25 million on the weekend, $90 million worldwide, almost all of it from China. It's playing here in North America. I kind of want to check it out. Basically, it held steady, almost unchanged from last weekend's gross. So this is getting great word of mouth. It's not anywhere near done yet. And number eight is Robin Hood, which is done. $20 million on the weekend. That's just about to hit $50 million worldwide. But this is falling hard and fast pretty much everywhere it's played. The opposite is true for Venom. That's the Spider-Man flick, in which Spider-Man doesn't appear, but it's the villain Venom. $13 million on the weekend. That's at just about $850 million worldwide. At number 10 is a new flick in North America, a horror film. There's a weird tradition of, like, the weekend after Thanksgiving, they release a horror film. Box Office Profit pointed that out. I have no idea why this tradition would exist, but it does. And this time it's The Possession of Hannah Grace, $10 million on the weekend. That's pretty much what it costs, so it should be okay when all is said and done, but not particularly well-reviewed in any way. At number 11 is the Mark Wahlberg comedy Instant Family. That's at $50 million worldwide. And number 12 is a film I'm going to see tonight. It's Monday when we're recording the show, and I want to see Widows. I've heard good stuff about this. $10 million on the weekend, $53 million worldwide. It's in like 61 territories. It still needs quite a ways to go to triple its budget, but I want to see the film and the performances. At number 13 is Default. This is a South Korean drama set during the negotiations with the International Monetary Fund, a film built around IMF negotiations. This was happening during the 1997 financial crisis in Korea, and this drama opened to $9 million on its opening weekend. The Nutcracker in the Four Realms is still playing. It's at $140 million worldwide. Right below that is the James Bond spoof, Johnny English Strikes Again. That passed the $150 million mark worldwide. A Star is Born is right below that at number 16. That goes to another $5 million. I'm not sure if they're going to rush this out onto DVD and Blu-ray or whether there'll be a new re-release once it gets Oscar nominations. But this film is at $360 million worldwide.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because a film like this, you know, I know you sent me an email over the week saying, wow, Venom is already, you know, going to hit at least, you know, early digital sell through sometime in December, right?
I mean, well, which is just normal. I'm just, my point was not that was unusual or surprising, but just, isn't this pretty much fast enough?
Yeah,
you know, well, for people who want to keep shortening the windows for big hit films, to me, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, yeah, and the reason they're doing that, of course, is because they are trying to cash in on holiday shopping. With A Star Is Born,
that's on the same schedule that it would be. I mean, Venom is not being rushed in out early to get to cash in on holidays. It's coming out exactly when it would be.
Correct. A Star Is Born, they can cash in on holiday shopping thanks to its soundtrack.
That's true. So you don't know whether you think the studio might want to do some quick
reissuing? No, I don't. Well, reissuing, yes, absolutely. Yeah,
it's not played out, you don't think?
No, I don't think so.
Back to the charts. At number 17 is Green Book. This has a little bit of good news. A mixed reviews, modest opening, but it did get picked out by some critics, at least the National Board of Review. It made $4 million this weekend. It's only playing in North America, but that's the best hold of any film in wide release in North America. So of all the big movies that are already out on a lot of screens, this did the best. So it's only at $14 million, but maybe the word of mouth isn't that bad. So it should be maybe okay. You know, maybe if they can keep getting more and more information, they will know. When I looked up on Amazon, by the way, the Star Is Born film does not have a release date for DVD or Blu-ray. So clearly they are not, you know, maybe it'll come in January to tie into Oscar nominations, or maybe they'll feel like there's a lot more room to play at the charts, you know, in the movie theaters. We'll have to see. And number 18 is 102 Not Out. That's an Indian comedy that was already out in India. Now it's opened up in China. It made $3 million this weekend, and it's at $16 million worldwide. Apparently, the title is a joke in cricket. If you love cricket, you get the joke. But me, it goes over my head. And I tried to look it up, but I failed.
Well, what I love is it's a comedy, okay, about a 102-year-old man threatening to send his 76-year-old son to an old folks' home.
depressing, and his father wants to set the world record for the longest lived man, and he doesn't want anybody negative around him. And his son is like, oh, I'm so old, oi, you know, that sort of thing. And yet, not with Yiddishisms, but perhaps Hindi expressions. And number 19 is Super Lopez, the Spanish live-action spoof of Superman. I had a pretty good hold, $2 million this weekend. That's at $4.6 million. So not great reviews as far as I can tell, but maybe it's finding its audience in Spain. Number 20 is Unstoppable, the Korean action flick about a retired gangster drawn back into a world of crime and violence when they kidnap his wife. That won't stand. $2 million on the weekend. At number 21, Save or Perish. Savour ou Perir. That was a horrible pronunciation. Sorry about that. $2 million on its opening weekend. This is a French drama about a firefighter who must learn sometimes even heroes need saving. He's in a tragic fire, he suffers terrible burns, and he has to go through rehab, but his loving and beautiful wife is there by his side. And number 22 is a re-release. It's Burn the Stage, the movie. This is the behind-the-scenes concert flick about the Korean boy band BTS, Burn the Stage, and their big tour. It grossed $1.7 million this weekend on a return to sort of one of those special screening events. It's made $13 million at the box office. That's even more impressive because it's pulled footage from a YouTube 8-part series that aired on YouTube Premium. So, you know, it's been on YouTube Premium. Then they put it in theaters and they've made another $14 million on it. Pretty good. And at number 23 is finally a Chinese release of a French crime drama in English language. If that's not confusing enough, welcome to the world of international co-productions.
And it stars Mel Gibson to make it right. Even more confusing.
It's a Mel Gibson crime film made in France, and now it's released in China. This is our new world. But Bloodfather opened up in China. It got pretty poor reviews everywhere else, but it made $1.7 million on its opening weekend. And that brings its total to $7 million. So, you know, every little extra penny helps. And number 24 is an Italian comedy. His Rose, C'est son Rosé. It's an Italian comedy co-written, directed, and starring Leonardo Peraccioni. $1.6 million on its opening weekend. I watched the trailer. All I can determine is it's a guy, sort of a slubby-looking guy, and lots of attractive women. That's why you direct your own film. And finally, at number 25, as we mentioned, is Crazy Rich Asians. They weren't sure if they were going to get a release in China. And when they did, nobody was sure how it would do. The answer is in. And what is it? It's nothing.
Yeah. Dead on arrival.
Dead on arrival. $1.2 million on its opening weekend. And it struggled to get there. Fell hard every day. And yet they're going to film the sequel in China. So well, it'd be interesting to see if that does any better down the road, but I'm sure they won't be counting on it, and they don't need to since it made so damn much money in North America.
Well, in China, speaking of China, Venom. Maybe the reason that Crazy Rich Asians didn't do well is because Venom made so much money, $250 million in China alone, and that's just as of, you know, right now over the past week.
No, I think it's up to $260 million right now. But yeah, so that's pretty great. So it's made more than it made in North America, and it did well there here as well. The one thing it won't do is get any critical acclaim. Right. Nobody liked this movie except audiences, but those are the ones that matter ultimately. But that's why there's this awesome divide between Oscar nominations and usually popular critic success. They're just not the same films. And the National Board of Review proved it again, didn't they? Their best film of the year is Green Book. Good Lord. That is a classic National Board of Review pick, a milquetoast mainstream movie for your mom type film that not everybody else is embracing, but it's just very MOR right down the middle. And they said that's the best film of the year. But beyond that, they had a lot of love for A Star Is Born, didn't they?
They did. I think they gave the director a nod to Bradley Cooper. The actress, best actress went to Lady Gaga, and best supporting actor went to Sam Elliott.
And was on their list of one of the 10 best films of the year.
Yeah, so was Black Panther, Cold War. That's a good movie, actually, Cold War. RBG and The Incredibles.
Oh, yeah. So that's their list, and we'll have to see who builds on it right up. To bat is the New York Film Critics. They named Roma their favorite film of the year, Alfonso Cuarón's Ode to His Maid. They also gave him Best Director and Best Cinematographer since he shot the film as well. And among their other top awards, Ethan Hawke for Best Actor in his film First Reformed, which also won Best Screenplay for Paul Schrader. Regina Hall, this was an out-of-left-field pick, Best Actress for Support the Girls, a movie I did miss. Richard E. Grant got Best Supporting Actor for Can You Forgive Me? And Regina Hill got Best Supporting Actress for If Beale Street Could Talk. I haven't seen that film yet. Best debut film was Eighth Grade, the Bo Burnham flick, which I really liked a lot. And Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse got Best Animated Film. Cold War, which you just gave a nod to, won Best Foreign Film. And Mind the Gap, a skateboarding flick, was Best Documentary. So that's the New York Film Critics. They're the artsy people. Next week, we're going to get the Golden Globe nominations, the SAG nominations, and LA Film Critics. That's Golden Globes is this week. And next week are the SAG nominations and the LA Film Critics. So it'll be 2 weeks, you know, when we come back on the 16th, well, all the stuff will be in. We'll be able to get a better sense of what movies are at least getting attention from critics and people like that.
Well, in animation, the Annies, the animation awards, Best Picture nominations went to Early Man, which is the Aardman film, Incredibles 2, Isle of Dogs, Ralph Breaks the Internet, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Yeah, those are all big films. I mean, Early Man has the name recognition of Aardman, even though it wasn't a big commercial hit. But all the rest are big, big studio flicks and very strong picks, I think, across the board. There's not a loser in the bunch. I mean, there are indie films that are getting squeezed out because the big movies are doing so well. I keep hearing Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is really good. I know another person who saw it beyond Jeff Boucher and said, wow, this is a really fun, good movie. It's really good. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that one. I did see Roma, and I have to say I was whelmed. I wasn't overwhelmed. I wasn't underwhelmed. I admired it, but it's not on my best of the year list, that's for sure.
Whoa, you stand amongst a few.
I'm meeting more and more people.
Okay.
More and more people. Yeah, no, as far as Oscar potential, keep in mind this film is a movie with non-actors, so it will get lots of nominations, I'm sure. It looks like it's going to be a breakthrough film that will get a Best Picture nomination for a foreign film. That doesn't happen a lot, and I think that's as far as it goes, because I don't think they're going to give Best Film with the SAG voting, with the actors voting in, to a movie that doesn't star actors.
You know, we haven't heard anything about this Marwyn film, the Steve Carell film.
Well, I've seen the trailers.
Yeah, so I guess
Robert Zemeckis is a big name, so there's always a possibility that some late movie will catch fire. I'm sure some will. You know, we've got a lot of big movies opening up in the next few weeks, so the list and the potential movies that are going to be up for Best Picture is still very, very up in the air.
Well, that's good news, right?
Well, sure. Well, you know, yeah, it's boring when there's one film that's dominating, except unless it's, you know, a great film and you're just excited that such a great film has come out that Lawrence of Arabia is going to sweep, in which case you're happy because you've seen a classic.
Well, there's good news for the movies. What about good news for books? This brings us to our book filter section. And I guess this week, there's not necessarily a book of the week.
And there won't be for the rest of the year because nothing comes out. All the books are in the store come Thanksgiving and Black Friday. And that means for the rest of the year, the releases are at the lowest point in all 365 days of the year. So hundreds of thousands of books come out every year, a million plus in North America if you count self-published. But from November, end of November through the end of December, nothing. Nothing. All the books are already out on the shelves waiting for you to buy them. So that means we have no pick of the week. But we did see a story on CBS News talking about, hey, Shakespeare and Company, a cool bookstore chain, is opening up a new location. And they said basically the bookstore is back. You know, yes, there were some hard times, but, you know, bookstores have risen like 30% since its low point in the early, late 2000s and blah, blah, blah. Bookstores are back, baby. But as we pointed out time and time again, at their peak, indie bookstores and the bookstore chains were like 3,500 locations around the country in the United States. Now it's down to like 2,200. So yeah, it's down up from its bottom, but it's nowhere near what it used to be. And you're really replacing, you know, giant superstores and big, robust chain store locations with tiny, tiny little co-ops and lovable little stores that I'm happy to see, but they're not remotely comparable. They have 1/10, 1/100th of the stock that some of these big stores have. And it's all captured pretty well in just an email that I saw the very day I saw this CBS News story. Every day, Publishers Weekly sends out emails, and every once in a while, they spotlight bookstore news. And they're happy to talk about anything. I mean, if you open up a cart in the middle of a mall in the floor, they'll say, hey, a new stand with some used books opened up. That's how desperate they are for news. And in this one email, they said, in Minneapolis, a Once Upon a Crime mystery bookstore was trying to raise $50,000 on GoFundMe to stay in business. That's nice. People love the store. I'm sure it's great. But when you have to beg for money to stay in business, that's not a good sign. A pop-up opened up in Massachusetts, but this guy's done this repeatedly. He'll open up for a few weeks or a month or two here, and then he'll do it somewhere else. And he said, look, this is not permanent. You know, unless people show up and start buying a lot of books, you know, I'd love to do it permanently, but I can't. A bookstore opened up in Japan with 2,000 books. That's a tiny little store, but they have no employees, which makes Barnes & Noble go, ooh, what a good idea. Newlyweds opened up a bookstore in Philly called A Novel Idea, which has new and used titles. That's actually good news. And another friendly story was about a bookstore in Baltimore, a profile of that store. And its owner talked about how they have to fight Amazon. They have stray cats that they help people that help find homes for. They use their space for tutoring to keep the lights on in the winter months. I mean, it's just there's not a lot of good books out there. And finally, in Connecticut, they lost a bookstore called Book Rack after 30 years. So it's cool that they're shining the spotlight. It's great that Shakespeare & Company has opened up a new store. But when stores open up, they tend to be really small and fragile, more like community centers than bookstores. And there's a lot of tough news out there. So don't get caught up in the hype.
You know, I just went to see a new movie theater here in Los Angeles. It's in Pacific Palisades. Mm-hmm. It's a Cinepolis theater. And it's in a new, I think it's called Palisades Village or Pacific Palisades Village. It's a new complex. And it's kind of like a little quaint little street that they, you know, it's a movie set, basically. I mean, they basically made a shopping mall.
That's a very funny way to describe it.
I mean, it's like, oh, look, Hometown America. No, you just basically made this last week, and it looks like Hometown America. You even have, like, you know, the little postal boxes and the bicycles that you can't move because it looks like, you know, you're in Disneyland here. But at the corner of it and at the entrance is the Amazon bookstore.
Right, which is not a great bookstore, frankly. Every time I walk into it, I think, what? This is so bizarre.
Yeah,
it's weird. Their mix of books. It's just you can't walk in and find – you can find probably the top 20 bestsellers, but everything else is so haphazard and catch as catch can. It feels so random that I just get frustrated when I go in there. It's hard to discover stuff, and that's what they really want to do. They want you to discover things, and it's just hard to do when you have that such a small, weird mix. I'd much rather have your local indie bookstore. Though, you know, I'll keep going back. I'll keep checking out new if they've changed the mix. Certainly Barnes & Noble keeps trying new things. I'll go into their stores and check them out. So, you know, you don't need to have 100,000 titles in order to have a good bookstore. So their smaller locations can work. But yeah, there's not a lot of great news out there, that's for sure. And there's not good news in sexual misconduct, but the news is there. So that's a change.
Yeah, I know. I don't know why somehow you said this is bad news for me or good news for me. I don't know why.
Or don't mention me in sexual misconduct.
Oh, okay.
that's probably what you're saying. Yeah. Yes, well, you said, I'm so glad there hasn't been any news lately. And I'm like, well, it's still happening. So, you know.
Oh, I said that last week. Yes.
Yes, you didn't hear. Anyway, it's sort of a bummer one. Neil deGrasse Tyson, a beloved figure, I would say. A very affable, nice guy who promotes astronomy and goes on TV. He's a great talk show guest. Good guy who does good work on astronomy as a public figure, but in his private life, perhaps not so much. He faces multiple claims of sexual misconduct and assault. I don't know if we covered this, but I don't remember this, but last year a musician said on the record that he raped her when they were grad students. Now two more women have come forward in a new story. They've named themselves. One is a former assistant who says she quit after repeated sexual advances, and the other one is a woman at Bucknell University who says he groped her at a 2009 event. DeGrasse Tyson had a lengthy Facebook post where he talked about all three women and the incidents and gave his side of the story and said he welcomed an independent investigation. And that's exactly what's happening with National Geographic and Fox, the producers of Cosmos, which has a sequel set to come out next year. They're both looking into it with an investigation. So we'll have to see what happens there. But in contrast to America, where that happens, people go, oh, shoot. Oh, darn it. I hope that's not true. And they wait to get the facts. In China, it's a little bit different. They're starting to grapple with Me Too and questions of sexual misconduct, but there's a big cultural gap here.
Yeah, I mean, Zhang Jinfu is one of China's, I guess he's one of their more popular young actors in China, and mostly on television. He's got 17 million followers on Weibo, which is their version of Twitter.
And he had a romantic story. He put his career on hold in April. He moved to Japan. He was taking language courses, and people are like, what's going on? And then they found out he started dating Japanese model Haruka Makaura. And so there was their lovely romance. But ever since they started dating, according to her, he's been abusive and beating the heck out of her. And she went public last week, posting images of her bruised and battered face and body, and says one beating caused her to miscarry their child.
Whoa.
Well, he apologized online, turned himself into the police.
So he's not even saying, oh, we need an investigation. He's like, oh, yeah, no, I did that. I should be in jail.
Yeah, well, I don't know that he's – I don't know what he apologized for specifically, whether he said I beat her or – you know, I'm not sure what level he apologized for or what he publicly admitted to saying specifically he did. But he did turn himself into the police and he did apologize after she accused him of beating her to the point where she miscarried her child. The shocker here is the reaction of other celebrities. They continued to defend him online and criticize her. Some of them posted comments like, it takes two to tango. And he's a sunny man, which is slang for someone who's really incapable of violence. And one female star said, I'm on his side.
So not even like saying, well, there's, you know, it's gray. She's like, no, I'm on his side.
Yeah. And some of them said, you know, she has ties to Yakuza, which is, you know, and someone else said, well, what if she's not perfect? Does that mean he gets to beat her up? So we've came across a survey in China. One survey shows most people believe domestic violence is a private matter rather than a crime, and they think it's best dealt with privately and by family rather than by the police. So there's a long way to go in China. So, you know, whatever happens with Neil deGrasse Tyson, at least we're farther along on the way, and hopefully China will pick up. In fairness, a lot of people pushed back against those celebs. They took down their tweets. They apologized. But the fact that they would even think of doing that in the first place shows they got a lot of work to do.
Well, thankfully, that wraps up sexual misconduct news for this week and moves us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, okay, we've got a little more detail about Warner Brothers' plan for that digital streaming service they're launching next year, and it's, well, it's confusing. We still don't know which of their pre-existing offerings will shut down or the overlap on the main site. Remember, Filmstruck just shut down. Well,
so they've got a new opening for Criterion, though. They announced that already, right? Yeah.
Yes. Now, the question is, will all the DC shows, all those, you know, DC comic shows be on Warner streaming site?
Because they've got their own separate site,
correct.
Which is very confusing anyway.
What we do know is that there will be multiple price levels, multiple tiers. Sure, Hulu and others offer free access with ads while paid subscribers don't have to watch commercials. But Warner Brothers is talking about three paid levels of service, a basic level with mostly movies, a step up that includes TV shows and blockbuster flicks, and finally, a super premium version with classics, kids programming, arty stuff, movies, and TV shows. Are you confused yet? Because, you know, if you are, so are we. And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I'm going to throw it back to you. I think it's a big whoop because we just don't really know what price level they're talking about or exactly what's going to be involved. And do they really expect people to pay for a DC service and this? Or maybe DC will be completely involved in this one and it'll just be duplicate service. But you have a theory as to what they're doing here.
Yeah, I mean, look, Warner Brothers, or I should say AT&T, said...
Or Warner Bros.
Warner Bros, yeah. I was going to actually kind of... say that, but I didn't know whether people who may not have heard last week's show would understand that reference. That said, AT&T was sued by the United States government for antitrust, and they said during the trial, no, we're not going to raise prices. We're not going to, act monopolistically. Very little will change. We're just, you know, we're a telecommunications company that's looking for content to put down our pipes. And the synergies here are, you know, there's lots of synergies and we will vertically integrate so that we can distribute easier and more efficiently. Well, yeah, one way to charge more for the same content is to tier it up, you know, basically create different product versions, which is exactly what they've done here.
Well, but I don't know. Can they be accused of raising prices on a service that didn't exist before?
No,
I mean,
well,
this is a brand new streaming service. So no matter what they charge, even if it was one level, and they charge $30, you couldn't say, well, they've raised the prices on it because it didn't exist.
No, however, let's say HBO Go. Let's just, you know, take that for example. That right now costs $15 a month, okay? But if you wanted to get the movies and the blockbusters plus HBO Go and they charge $20 per month, Well, okay, now...
That's a lot of added value, though, depending.
I guess, you know, if they take HBO Go away, then you're forced to buy the $20 version. Technically, they've raised the price for HBO Go. Well, not, sorry, technically they haven't because it's a brand new product, but essentially they've raised the price for HBO Go.
Well, you know, if you got HBO plus everything else for $20, I think you'd be happy and you think that that was a good deal, but we'll have to see. I think it's confusing. There's not enough information. We don't know exactly the content available on all these levels and how it overlaps with HBO Go and DC and whatever that service is. So it's just a big mess. And why they bothered to announce this right now, I don't know.
I have no idea either. I don't know whether... I think a part of it is they took Filmstruck away, and this was the Criterion kind of classic movie streaming service that people loved. And, people were diehard fans of it. No. Although they only had 160,000, you know, customers, those that were customers loved it.
Yeah, no. They got blowback from critics and journalists and you know, a few directors. It was a meaningless thing that almost no one subscribed to. So they're like, well, we're going to get rid of it. And be like, oh, don't do that. So they... You know, they made nice and kept something, the lights on for Criterion. But that's unimportant in the scheme of things. That's a small, small play. So I don't think they'd announce this to cover that up or describe anything. It's just a confusing announcement.
I would agree. You know what's not confusing? This next story about Hugh Jackman. Because Broadway, my friends, it is so... What's the best word to describe it? I'm small, really. It's just tiny. It's tiny. It's like a little microscopic dot. And while Hugh Jackman can sell out on Broadway anytime he wants, he's thinking bigger. The Greatest Showman has decided to make like Peter Allen, and he'll be touring arenas worldwide. See The Boy from Oz for that reference. Jackman will hit 34 locations in all, including the O2 Arena in London and Madison Square Garden in New York, winding up at the Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles on July 19th and 20th. As of yet, there are no dates in Australia and no live concert on Netflix tied into it, but surely at least one of those will happen soon. Jackman will have a full orchestra and do songs from Les Mis, The Greatest Showman, and other stage and film classics. Tickets are going on sale at HughJackman.com. Not Ticketmaster? Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop.
What?
Nobody but Hugh Jackman can do this. So it's not like it's a trend or anything, but No. You know, he can do whatever he wants. He can play Broadway. He can tour. He can make big movies. He doesn't have a lot of big hit films outside of Wolverine, but The Greatest Showman is the exception. That was a big hit, and he definitely helped in that. That was a sensation, and it's right up his, you know, sweet spot of, you know, Broadway and musicals. So full credit to him, and when he was deciding what to do next, he could have just done another stint on Broadway. It would have been easy, but he said, I'm going to tour. I'm going to have fun. So it's just kind of cool to see a multi-talented guy head out to the world, and I'm fascinated by the fact that he's selling tickets on his own website. I don't know how that works when you've got all these big arenas in play.
Yeah, well, it might be, you know, through HughJackman.com, but Ticketmaster is the back end, in which case, you know, it doesn't really matter.
You pay the big fees anyway.
Right. You know, I don't know if I ever told this story on this show, but when Hugh Jackman was on Broadway in The Boy from Oz, the, you know, Peter Allen's bio musical, I was staying at the Paramount Hotel in New York, and every night after the show, he would... come out backstage, and the Paramount Hotel, the front door of the Paramount Hotel, looked out onto the backstage door for...
There were thousands of people,
Oh my God. And he'd come out and there'd be screams. And I just thought, you could always tell what time it was based on when you heard the screams.
It's got to be a fun way to live.
Exactly. Now, Glenn Beck is announcing big new plans. After tightening its belt to ensure the company was in the black, The Blaze is merging with another right-wing media company, Mark Levin's CRTV, to create Blaze Media. The Blaze TV channel is carried on various outlets like DirecTV, Roku, Verizon, Fios, Sling, and some regional cable outlets. It's also heard on radio platforms Sirius XM and iHeartRadio, and while its potential audience is big, at least it's big there, it's unclear how many actual listeners Beck reaches. Levin has a show on Fox News and a nationally syndicated radio show. He also has a TV channel that features folks like Michelle Malkin, Phil Robertson of Duck Dynasty, and Gavin McInnes, who Vice would like people to forget was involved with that company's founding. McInnes hosts a show called Get Off My Lawn, which admittedly is pretty funny. Is there strength in numbers? They're about to find out, but for us, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop, and here's what we'll take a little criticism of Hollywood Reporter. The headline called this a media powerhouse, a conservative media powerhouse. Not so fast. You know, a few years ago, Glenn Beck said he was going to get into making movies. Nothing ever happened on that front. And as Hollywood Reporter rightly pointed out, The Blaze has cut 20% of its staff in the last few years. They've lost big talent like an NRA spokesman and Tommy Lahren, that pretty hateful Fox News figure. So he's not doing great. The other channel's not doing great. We don't know what their actual audiences are. So maybe it's smart of them to get together, but it's not like they're moving from strength to strength to get even bigger. They're maybe trying to figure out a way to have enough people on to survive. But my favorite part of the story is the last quote from Glenn Beck. Right at the end of the story, he said, "First and foremost, I'm an artist and a storyteller." Okay.
I thought you were like a news guy, but all right. So many deals are being signed by so many directors, producers, actors, writers, and maybe storytellers like Glenn Beck. So many of those deals are being signed that it's hard to keep track of them all. But this one was a little odd. Director Ava DuVernay struck a high eight-figure deal with Warner Bros. TV. If you don't have your calculator out, by the way, high figures means the deal could be around, say, $75 million. That's not the strange part. DuVernay is a red-hot Emmy-winning talent who created the hit show Queen Sugar on OWN, has a mid-season show debuting on CBS called Red Line, and tons of other projects, like the documentary Central Park 5, which she did for Netflix, a comedy based on the life of Colin Kaepernick, and so on. Hey, we can just forget A Wrinkle in Time happened, right? We can do that? Because, Good. The strange part is that there's no mention in the deal about the future of Warner Brothers Television. It's been in a bit of a funk, even though the producer of Arrow, Supergirl, and The Flash, Greg Berlanti, just re-upped. And of course, Warner Brothers has merged with AT&T and plans to launch a massive new streaming service in 2019. See our first story. Where does DuVernay fit in amidst all of those changes? Not a word about that. If someone signed with Fox as it merged with Disney, wouldn't you expect them to make nice noises about how they'd be a key content provider in Disney plus Fox and so on? I don't know.
No, Disney Plus is their streaming service.
Ah, Disney Plus. Okay. I see Disney Plus. Yeah, okay. I see how that would read as Disney Plus. Okay. Well, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's just a indication of the confusion as they merge. I don't think it's telling in any way, shape, or form that this isn't a big deal and they're not excited about having her around. I'm shocked, however, by your pronunciation of her name. Is that how it's pronounced?
Ava DuVernay?
Yeah.
You could say Ava DuVernay. I've heard it pronounced Ava DuVernay.
Well, I mean, we want to pronounce it the right way, shouldn't we?
When I worked with her, I worked with her as a publicist, when she was a publicist. And she, pitched me on, that's how she started her career here in Los Angeles. Uh-huh.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, you should know then. How did she pronounce her name?
Ava DuVernay.
Okay, well, there you go. Well, if she said that to you, then who cares how other people pronounce it? Good to know. I think it's just confusion. They don't know what's going on, I don't think they could really indicate, but still, it was sort of a dropped ball. It seemed a little odd that, you're going into this big, huge new situation, and they're not saying, and she's a big part of our whole big plans for this streaming service and all that sort of stuff. So, we'll see what happens.
Consider this a twofer. YouTube is not having fun chasing after subscribers for its premium service. And, at the same time, YouTube has discovered the joy of ads. They can make content available on YouTube for free and make money that way, whether it's a classic movie like Legally Blonde or a new series that they've greenlit like the Karate Kid spinoff, Cobra Kai. It seems YouTube will have less original content to make available for free since they seem to be pulling back from that arena. As everyone and their mother spends a bundle making original scripted content, YouTube may also have decided it's a lot easier to let people create their own content, see which one sticks, and then, make money on the ads. Big deal or big whoop?
Yeah, so this is what YouTube is going back to the way they were at the beginning. They were creating original content. They had an exclusive premium site called YouTube Red. They've pulled back. They're like, never mind.
Yeah.
If we make original content, we'll make it available for free on our platform to everyone, and we'll have ads. But they're also going to be making less original content. So, you know, they're pulling back on multiple levels here, back on the premium tier and pulling back on original content. So what new stuff they do create, that's going to be available for free, but you got to watch ads. And you can see why there's so much competition. Facebook just started streaming episodes of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel and Firefly, all those Joss Whedon TV shows. They're just putting them on Facebook. You got to watch ads, of course, but they just want to grab eyeballs, and everybody is doing this.
And Instagram is doing the same thing with IGTV. And, you know, maybe that's why BTS, the K-pop band, said, wait, no more premium? Then forget it. We're taking our 8 episodes and we're putting them together and we're launching, like, releasing a movie.
Well, I think that was always part of the plan, but yes.
Have we traded one behemoth for another? The right-wing company Sinclair faced backlash when it aired or tried to acquire the TV stations of Tribune. We kind of talked about this at length a couple of times. The resulting media empire would have a massive national reach in terms of local stations, and people were already criticizing Sinclair for its Fox Newsification of local TV. A country that values diverse voices in local stations covering local stories wasn't pleased by Sinclair's reach or the propaganda it forced local stations to air. Now, when the Sinclair deal fell apart, the Texas-based company Nexstar saw an opportunity. Now, it's the one acquiring both the WGN cable channel and Tribune string of local TV stations. That gives Nexstar an empire that adds 42 more stations to their mix of 170 stations covering 39% of the country's population. They'll have to give up second stations in some markets and reduce their overall size a little to get approval, but it will still make Nexstar the largest owner of TV stations in the country, and it only costs them, like, you know, $4.1 billion, so, you know, chump change. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, and here's where I prove that it wasn't just conservative, you know, bias against conservatives that made me object to Sinclair's deal. This deal too should be blocked. It should not happen. It's just too big. The point of local TV stations is local. And when one company owns them all, then that falls apart. So, you know, it's a big problem.
Yeah, you know? I would agree with you. Owning 39% of the
which they already do.
Yeah, it's way too big. I mean, you think Facebook can sway an election? Forget about Facebook. What about owning, you know, nearly 40% of the news channels and networks in a particular country? It's too big.
Yeah.
Although maybe, you know, in France and Canada and other places, maybe there are companies that own that much of the media. I don't know. You can write to us and let us know. Now, speaking of other countries, way back in 2013, 20th Century Fox was getting into the theme park business. It announced a deal with a Malaysian resort company to open Fox World, a theme park built around Fox properties like, say, Planet of the Apes and Ice Age. The Malaysian company would do all the work, build the park and hotels and casinos, and Fox would collect fees every step of the way. The company is suing, the Malaysian company that is, for $1.75 billion and claims Fox threw up roadblocks to get better terms. They got them all right, Fox did, but then the merger happened. Now Disney wants to scuttle the deal since it would compete with Disney's own attractions. Disney and Fox say it's just a question of buyer's remorse. The company claims it has already spent $750 million, but the park was supposed to open in 2016, and now it's been pushed back to 2019. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I guess it all depends on the actual status of the theme park. Apparently, rides based on Independence Day and Night at the Museum are near completion. But it's the whole park has to open. You can't open with two rides. So if this company, you know, if they go to court and Disney can just show, hey, look, they're still not open. They're not opening. So why, you know, we're out. If they can prove that, then it falls apart. But if this company can prove, hey, Fox made it hard for them to open, they wouldn't cooperate to get certain merchandising deals in place and certain, you know, rides signed off on by the people who own them. And they can say, look, they made it really hard for us to do it. And now they want to back out and we're out $1 billion and we want our money back. you know, it's going to be a big, ugly court case. I don't think they're going to settle this anytime soon because it's a lot of money.
Yeah, you know, look, you can have rides at different theme parks that you don't control necessarily. You're basically licensing the intellectual property. I mean, if you look at Universal Studios, they have a Simpsons ride. I wonder what's going to happen there. Is Disney going to turn to Universal and say, hey, we're pulling that ride?
Well, they may when the contract wears out, but I'm sure there's a long clause in there for, you know, the rights to the ride for 20 years. You know, you can't suddenly say, take down your ride. I'm sure that's all worked out in the contracts.
Yes, I'm sure it is. And as well, it should be in the contract with the Malaysian company.
Right. The point is that the theme park's not happening and they're out $1 billion. So they want their money. The company's saying, well, give us $1 billion. You know, the point is not, are they going to open up and have these rides? The point is, you know, the whole thing's collapsed and who's going to pay who?
Right. Well, since we're talking about international territories, at least international to us, why don't we stick with that theme during Inside Baseball? Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And if you're in India, this really affects you. But in the entertainment world, India is a hot topic. I mean, all the big media players want a piece of India. Of course, they're battling it out in music and streaming video, but it ain't easy. India is a hugely complicated territory, even more so than China. Here are some of the facts, but keep in mind, we're approaching this from a U.S. media angle, and the local markets include a lot of players we barely recognize. For instance,
heck, that may be the whole point of our piece.
Yeah, I mean, for instance, if I said Karim, right, you would say, what are you talking about? Well,
about a what?
Yeah, exactly. That's the Uber of Pakistan, and I believe they're also in India, and a certain, I think they're in Dubai and the Emirates. So you know what? There are companies out there that don't play in Europe or the US that we're not familiar with, especially in streaming video and streaming music.
Right. So Netflix, Disney, Amazon, Et al., Apple, they all are slugging it out in India. And there's two big areas, you know, if there's TV streaming, you know, video streaming, and there's music streaming, which has slightly different players battling it out. But first, we'll look at video streaming. And India is expected to have 500 million users available online by 2023. They expect it to be an $18 billion market in terms of people paying for streaming video subscriptions and, I assume, the ad money. If so, most of those people would be watching on their phones. 36% of people in India have smartphones now, and they expect that to hit 60% by 2023.
Well, now, and keep in mind, that number of people, 500 million, the U.S. has 320 million people living in it. So they have 500 million people, and that's not their population, obviously. That's just those people that would be streaming music and video online.
Right, that's people with smartphones or TVs,
right,
and
exactly.
You know, who are ready to pay for something.
Now, Disney's purchase of Fox assets included Murdoch's Star India TV network, and that has 60 channels, and I guess it has Hotstar, which is a leading streaming service that owns the rights to cricket, which is a big sport in, well, not only India, but Pakistan and the UK and elsewhere.
Right, there are three gods in India. There's God, and there's Bollywood, and there's cricket.
Okay, so I'm pretty sure none of those are gods. I'm just going
to... don't tell them that. You really want the rights to cricket, that's for sure. And remember, you know, cricket unifies the country, but it's also wildly diverse. There are more than 20 languages, lots of different cultures, lots of levels of education, far more than even, say, North America. And so while there's differences between the South and the North and, you know, California, Berkeley and, you know, Mississippi, I think it pales in comparison to when you're talking about all the different languages and cultures that are vibrant and need their own content to feel, you know, appreciated and have something that they actually want to pay for.
In fact, I was in a meeting when I was in Dubai recently with two people from India, both of them from Mumbai. One of them called Mumbai, Mumbai. The other called it Bombay. It's, I guess...
Colonial.
Yeah, thank you. I was forgetting the word colonial for a second. And
that's how colonial you are.
Exactly. But both could actually tell where the other was from, not down to the block, but definitely the part of the region that they were from because of the way they spoke certain words, because
of course,
of the languages.
We say y'all, you know, you'd be like, oh, they must be from the South.
Right.
you know, you hear a New England accent. Yeah, so it's like that all over the world. But, you know, everybody's battling out and everyone is creating local content. Every day I seem to see a new story. Amazon, for example, has 30 different India-centric shows in the works. They've just announced their first Tamil drama. And in comparison, Netflix has 24, including the just-wrapped action film Dhaka. So every day there's some new story and they're all fighting for consumers. But let's keep in mind, the average salary in India is maybe several dollars a day. So the most popular services right now is not something like Netflix where you pay a lot of money. It's free sites like YouTube, which has 40% of all online revenue from video in Indian market. But there is TV stuff as well. There is over-the-top services. It's just very fragmented. And you talked about how it's a complicated country, a lot of bureaucracy, a fair amount of corruption, but it's a lot more open than, say, China, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I mean, you could actually, in China, you have to have a Chinese partner, and it's far more closed off.
So who is the big players right now in video services? Who's got what piece of the pie?
Well, you just mentioned YouTube at 40%. Hotstar, which will, I guess, be owned by Disney, has 23% and charges $3 a month. Netflix has 14% and charges $7 a month. Amazon has 6% and charges $2 per month. So that's video.
Right. So yeah, Amazon has a smaller percentage, and probably because they don't have the content people want as much. They don't have a lot of content and they don't have a lot of India-centric content. So, you know, you're free and you've got India content, you're doing great, like YouTube. You're not free, but you're the least, you know, pretty inexpensive. $3 a month for Hotstar. You've got a lot of India content, so that's why they're number two. You got to make Indian content. So it's not so much about, hey, here's the marvelous Mrs. Maisel. It's about creating new content and signing up with local partners to provide the movies and TV shows that they already have in India.
Well, then that brings us to streaming music, and Spotify has been eager to launch in India for a while now. The streaming service lags behind Apple Music, Amazon, and Google, not to mention local players like JioSaavn. I'm sure I butchered that name, and China's Tencent is there as well. However, given far lower subscription fees and the vastly complicated Indian market, the entire pie is only around $35 million a year. That could grow tremendously, and Spotify obviously wants to be there.
That's right, and we saw a story in Music Business Worldwide, a site I've been going to more and more. They had an exclusive about this, and Spotify wanted to enter into India, but they felt they had to sign up the U.S. majors, and those people were dragging their heels and signing the contracts. Why? Because they were still annoyed by Spotify signing up some direct deals with indie artists. And so on the one hand, Spotify is signing up indie artists directly, like sort of Amazon did with writers. And on the other hand, they said, hey, let's sign a deal so we can break into India. And they're like, yeah, we'll get to that next week.
Yeah, we're not saying no, but we're not saying yes.
Right. And of course, music in India, just like video, it's dominated by local players, dominated a lot by Bollywood musicals and the attendant stars that those create and support. It's a hugely fragmented market, lots of local talent, lots of local labels. So cracking India is a lot more like having to crack all of Europe, where Germany has very different tastes than France, which is very different tastes than England.
On that level, then, whether Spotify could launch without even dealing with Sony, Warner Music, or Universal Music.
Well, they could, though Sony is the one they would really want because they're by far the biggest player in the local market. They're the one that has local talent signed up. So if you want anyone, it would be Sony. But yeah, you could make deals and open up. And in fact, they do have a deal with India's T-Series, which is a video channel on YouTube. And a company that has all sorts of stuff going on, and they've got lots of Bollywood stars and lots of pop stars, and on their YouTube channel, they're vying with PewDiePie to be the biggest YouTube channel in the world, meaning more subscribers than anyone else in the world. The New York Times just did a story about them and their YouTube channel, and as far as their record label is concerned, they have signed up with Spotify. So that's the thing you got to do if you want to be a player in this market, but it's going to be a hard nut to crack.
Well, I don't think there's much more we can add about India that we haven't said already, at least in terms of streaming video or streaming music. But that brings us to our obituary section. And this week we have some sad news that Steven Hillenburg, the creator of SpongeBob SquarePants, died at the age of 57.
Yeah, he had Lou Gehrig's disease, also known as ALS. He announced, I think last year or the year before, that he was dealing with it, and he just kept working right up to the end as long as he could. I interviewed him when the first episode, when the SpongeBob started as a series. The first episode aired in May of 1999, May 1st, 1999. And then the official launch came a few months later. That's when I got a chance to chat with him because I just thought it was a great pilot. And my God, what a hit show. Some 250 episodes, a hit feature film. The Broadway show wasn't as successful, but it got some nice stuff and tons of toys. But, you know, a really important delightful franchise, if that's the way to put it. But great series, great spirit.
Also passing away this past week was Oscar-nominated screenwriter Gloria Katz. And if that name sounds familiar, there's a good reason, because she wrote American Graffiti, helped out on Star Wars, though was uncredited, wrote Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
All with her husband, Willard Hayek, we should say. Hoyk, or however you say his name, H-U-Y-C-K. So they co-wrote all this stuff together.
Right, and Lucky Lady, Liza Minnelli and Burt Reynolds and Gene Hackman, 19-year-old Robbie Benson, and was directed by Stanley Donen in 1975.
Right, that's an unimportant film in the scheme of things, but I was 9 or 10 years old when that hit HBO, and I watched it about 87 times.
By the way, they played it nonstop, I'm sure.
They did. I thought Robbie Benson was really talented and I wanted to hang out with him. But anyway, George Lucas visited that set of Lucky Lady because, remember, they had worked on American Graffiti with him, and now they were working on Star Wars, sort of. And he really liked the crew, and he recruited a lot of them to work on Star Wars. So that odd little film, which was kind of not a big flop, it doubled its budget, but it was a weird flick. It did lead to lots of people working on Star Wars, so that's kind of interesting. So she and her husband, they got an Oscar nomination for their work on American Graffiti, and per her, they did major rewrites on the follow-up Star Wars. They injected humor, they turned Leia into a capable leader rather than, you know, a damsel in distress, and she says they wrote about 30% of the final dialogue, but Lucas was very determined that they should not get credit for it. He wanted it to be just, you know, George Lucas, and, you know, given the other scripts in Star Wars that were officially written by him, I believe her.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to say, well, you know, you kind of did yourself in on that one.
And yeah, you know, we believe her. They helped on that one and they didn't help on the rest. But they did write Howard the Duck and Radioland Murders. And after that, they couldn't get arrested.
That makes perfect sense.
They just, nothing happened after that. Just nothing for the last 30 years of their life. Oh, well.
Well, also Emmy-winning casting director
Alex Gordon.
Okay, well, why don't you tell us about her, because I'm not familiar with her.
Well, she died at 96. She was born in Dayton, Ohio. She was a DJ. She sang with a big band. She tried a little acting, and then she became a casting director. She broke out in TV on shows like Studio One, which is a live television show where they did, you know, live stuff. And she worked on The Defenders, which is one of the big early hits of television. It won Best Drama 3 years in a row, including their debut season when she won, when she was their casting director, one of them. She also won an Emmy for casting the miniseries Separate But Equal, starring Sidney Poitier. But her big thing is that she had a good, solid movie career and a long collaboration with director Alan J. Pakula. She did Clute, she did Sophie's Choice, and almost all a bunch of his other movies. She also worked on Pritzi's Honor, Scarface, Summer of 42, The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, and I was so fascinated by her career, I thought, wow, what a great casting director. She got an Emmy. She won an Emmy. I wonder if she ever got an Oscar nomination.
Well, an Oscar nomination for
how? Exactly. I forgot, of course, that they don't offer Oscar nominations for casting directors, as they should, but that isn't eligible. So there you go. That explains that. But she was a lesbian. She was at 91 years old. She got married to a woman, Georgiana Jagiello, at 91. And Jagiello was the director of the Center for Reproductive Services at Columbia University. She assisted on the first in vitro birth in New York City, so that's a pretty cool partner. But earlier in life, she lived for a decade in Manhattan with writer Louise Fitzhugh, the author of Harriet the Spy. And if you're a lesbian, that's like a trifecta. I mean, Harriet the Spy is an iconic character for young lesbians, trust me. So a very cool, interesting career.
Well, also, Ken Barry, an actor on F Troop and Mama's Family and Mayberry RFD, he died at the age of 85.
What an affable guy. That's just the phrase that comes to mind.
Well, I love the story about how Buster Keaton called him up one day and complimented the gag he'd done the night before on TV. I mean, think about it. That's That's pretty cool with Buster Keaton calling. I mean, although, how would you know it's Buster Keaton calling? Because you'd pick up the phone and there'd be nothing on the other end of the line, right?
Right, right. Well, he knew him, but they never talked much about work. And, you know, Buster was kind of a shy guy, but he knew him. And he created all his own gags on F Troop. And that's what he was known for, bumbling around and doing all this shtick. And on season two, the premiere episode, they said, all right, we want you to do some big gag during the opening credit sequence. You know, go nuts, do whatever you want. So he actually had a lot of time. And he got this gag and he had this set up and a bale of hay. And he created this long, elaborate stunt where he's reading a letter and walking up a plank and falling over and flipping over. It keeps reading the letter. So it's the most elaborate stunt he ever got to do. And that was the one where Buster Keaton called him up and said, hey, good job. So he had a, you know, he had a good career. He worked for decades, a ton of work. Mama's Family, a Carol Burnett Show, Mayberry RFD, tons of episodes of other TV shows. Lots of legends picked him out early on and worked with him. Lucille Ball, Carol Burnett, Bob Newhart, Dick Van Dyke. They all spotted his talent and used him. But looking back on it, he says the best time of his life was when he was working on those two seasons on F Troop. So, you know, he's a dancer, a singer, a choreographer. He worked in the Disney film Herbie Rides Again. And if you saw him, you'd go, oh, yeah, that guy. You know, a nice career.
Well, and it was a career that was started off by his sergeant in the military, one Leonard Nimoy.
That's right. Yeah, Leonard Nimoy was, you know, Leonard Nimoy saw he was talented and he was working with, you know, soldiers who were doing military shows and stuff like that. And Ken won a contest or two and he was headed to the Ed Sullivan Show. You know, he won a contest that got him a gig appearing on the Ed Sullivan Show. And Leonard Nimoy said, well, you know, you need to meet with agents and, you know, you need to meet with people, make sure, you know, you capitalize on this. And Ken Berry was like, well, how the hell would I do that? That's Leonard Nimoy said, all right, let me take care of that. And he made sure that he lined up studio execs and agents. And that's when Hollywood paid attention and, you know, took off for him. You're taking off now, aren't you, for Hong Kong? We won't see you for 2 weeks.
That is true. That is true. But you can always subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find us the Google Play Store. And please do rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do. It helps others find the show as well. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of that information, again, is on our website. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's Duvernay.com.
Okay, well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com where all of his work is aggregated, or check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading. It's the holidays. Know what books you should be buying. Although you just said nothing's coming out, so I don't know. Maybe do you have picks right now?
Yes, but they're very modest.
Okay, well, some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until 2 weeks from now, play nice.